From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's May, which means students in colleges and universities across Illinois are taking final exams or finishing up projects or papers, if they're not already done. It's a stressful time for students, so some might feel tempted to try and ease up their workload, maybe looking for ways to get assignments done without actually having to do them. And that might lead them to ChatGPT to help write that 15-page thesis. Indeed, the AI tool has captured a lot of media attention because of its remarkable capabilities. But that's also why it's been the subject of some controversy, and particularly with regard to the role it has in the classroom, the moral issues associated with having someone else, or rather something else, do your work for you, and how much students can actually learn using this kind of program. Our producer, Jose Zepeda, went out on the quad at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign to hear what students had to say about the role of AI in higher education.
I mean, I think it would be helpful for people to, I mean, if people like utilize it in the right way, I think ChatGPT is a great tool to enhance level of education, I think.
But I think it could be a helpful tool for like trying to gather like, as like a first start, but I think people use it as the final step, like the first and only step to like the process. So I think the learning is being drawn out of it.
It could be useful if people use it like as like a way to set up a prompt or a way to just gather ideas in a way that they can like put their own spin to it and then like just go from there. So there are benefits to it on ChatGPT, but it just depends on like how much people try to use and abuse it.
I think it could be used in a similar way as like things like Grammarly, just for editing or fixing like clarity, that kind of stuff. But I know a lot of people use it for just like straight up cheating.
All right. Well, joining us now to talk about AI in higher education is Ted Underwood, professor and associate dean of academic affairs at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's School of Information Sciences. Ted, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here, Brian.
Also with us is Ellie Buxton, Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Illinois Springfield. Ellie, welcome to the 21st Show to you. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Listeners, as ever, we want to invite you to join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. What do you think about AI? Have you tried using ChatGPT? I've done some experimenting with it to help think through questions and interview segments. I've never, you know, taken its output and put it directly on air, but I am curious about it. Are you? What do you want to know about it? And maybe would you like to have had AI as a tool in your education? Let us know at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Ellie, I'm going to begin with you. To help our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with this topic, can you just give us a general explanation of what artificial intelligence is?
Sure. So in a nutshell, artificial intelligence are basically computer programs that try to simulate human intelligence in different domains, such as vision, language understanding, and the powerhouse of AI today are these algorithms called artificial neural networks, which basically consist of a collection of connected computation units called artificial neurons, and which is loosely inspired based on how neurons are connected in human brain. The most basic form of these algorithms have been around actually for 70 years now. But what makes this algorithm very powerful today are two things. One, the availability of the vast amount of digital data. And second, we have much more compute power that we had before.
I'm going to add a word into our definitions here, and that is generative. So what is generative AI in particular?
So generative AI, I'm going to start with these large language models, which is an example of generative models. So large language models, they are trained on a vast, they're artificial neural network models that are trained on a vast portion of text database that's available on the internet. such as all the Wikipedia text, scientific journals, books, novels, news articles, etc. And they are trained to perform a very simple intuitive task. And that task is to predict the next word in a sequence of words. So a generative model is the model that predicts the next token in a sequence, then what comes next in a sequence.
So it says, just like take a word in the English language and what is the most likely next word and just repeat and repeat and repeat. And that's actually what GPT stands for, right? Generative pre-trained transformer.
Yes. And generative means it generates a sequence of words. Pre-trained means it has been trained on this large portion of internet text. And a transformer is a specific type of artificial neural network, which basically has the ability to understand which portion of the text that it has received it should pay more attention to.
Ted Underwood, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk about your own experience observing and watching the development and growth of these large language models and GPT in particular?
Sure. They've been around for several years and have been exciting and fun to play with for several years, maybe useful in research. But the broad public didn't get interested in them until last fall, when some changes were made, ways they were fine-tuned, that made it easy for them to just answer questions or follow instructions. And at that point, people could start treating them as sort of oracles. Write me a poem or answer this random question. Before that, it hadn't been easy to use them that way. But once people could do that, they really took off.
Indeed. And yeah, I had GPT. We wanted to post to get some recommendations for somebody to do some repair of concrete in the town where we live. And I had GPT try and write me a clever message for a social media post that would get more engagement. I thought it did pretty well. I'll leave it to other people to guess whether we actually got anything out of it. But let's turn to the classroom use, because that's the main sort of focus we're talking about today. What have you been hearing from colleagues and students about how they are using ChatGPT and in particular and AI in general on assignments?
So it's definitely clear that a lot of students are using this to do their homework. I hear that from a number of colleagues and from students. And in many cases, it's a problem. Assignments that we have right now are designed in a way where often they're asking for a paragraph, short answer to a simple question. And that's the kind of thing ChatGPT can do really well. But if a student is just getting the model to answer their question for them, obviously they're not learning very much.
And I guess we can come back to the idea of how faculty might be integrating it in a more positive way. But Ellie Buxton, what about you? Are you having students who are using AI or trying to use AI or GPT in your classes? And Ellie, are you with us? Or maybe you're muted?
Oh, I apologize. I was muted.
No, it's all right. It happens all the time in our Zoom era.
Yeah. So certainly now we had one semester of experience with this tool. In fact, I noticed halfway through the semester that the students were copying and pasting ChatGPT generated code for their assignments. And the reason I was able to detect that was, you have this student that have a certain pattern of coding and all of a sudden they turn in code that is very well documented, but fabricated, has some fabricated functions or doesn't run. So I tried to think about ways, just like anybody else, to maybe incorporate these tools into my classes. So I came up with assignments to ask a student, okay, first try to do the assignment yourself. Now have ChatGPT prompt the assignment questions to ChatGPT. Have ChatGPT generate the code for you. Then read the code that was generated by ChatGPT, interpret and debug it and try to fix it.
How could you tell? You say more about how you could tell. And I'll say, for those of us who aren't computer science grad students, how you can tell looking at code that it was something that was generated by GPT as opposed to your student.
Well, When you cover coding, when we cover coding in our classes, we start with some basic levels of coding. And if the students go beyond that basic levels and use some functions or something we didn't cover in class, but also the way that they write it is ChatGPT writes code is it's very well documented. So you have these students that maybe not before documenting their code, all of a sudden they're very well documenting their code. They're explaining because ChatGPT explains what each line of code does. But more important than that, a lot of times the code does not run or have some fabricated information that doesn't exist. So for example, they use some functions in a language that doesn't have that function, or it doesn't produce a coherent answer. If you have a sequence of instruction, for example, the answer that they produce to each segment might be correct for that individual segment, but not necessarily when you look at the other, when you put it with the other segments. So if a student's pattern of coding all of a sudden changes, then you can say that's something going on.
Oh, that's very interesting. So, and I think if I'm understanding correctly, let's say you have a piece of code that wants to get an input from a user, right? So you'd write whatever the function is in that language, get input, and then to document it, you'd say, okay, here's where we're going to ask the user to tell us their name or something like that. And you're saying some students maybe don't do that, GPT does. And that's your clue that maybe they're copy and pasting.
That is one of the clues. Yes,
yeah,
as an instructor, we have we kind of understand the pattern that the students write code, and if it's something outside that pattern, that we know that they got that information maybe from some other sources.
Ted, can you speak to maybe from a more of a humanities, history, political science, English, whatever subject somebody might be using GPT in? What are some of the tells that an instructor might look for?
Oh, I mean, sure. The classic one is what's called hallucination, because the model is designed to predict things that sound reasonable, but it doesn't necessarily look up everything that it's saying and check the facts. So sometimes it will write a beautiful paragraph, but reference a book, a source that doesn't actually exist if you look it up. So that, that's a pretty clear sign.
Abraham Lincoln inspired Americans to go to the moon.
Exactly. Yeah.
all right. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Saul Khan, who's the founder and CEO of Khan Academy, the education group. He's talking about the role that AI can have in a student's education.
But I think we're at the cusp of using AI for probably the biggest positive transformation that education has ever seen. And the way we're going to do that is by giving every student on the planet an artificially intelligent but amazing personal tutor. And we're going to give every teacher on the planet an amazing artificially intelligent teaching assistant. And just to appreciate how big of a deal it would be to give everyone a personal tutor, I show you this clip from Benjamin Bloom's 1984 Two Sigma study, or he called it the Two Sigma problem. That could take your average student and turn them into an exceptional student. It can take your below average student and turn them into an above average student.
All right, Ted, what do you think about that? An AI TA for every student at every level?
So there may be a little bit of exaggeration there. Obviously, he's pitching a product, but it's not wrong to say this is a really exciting development and that it could lead in good directions. I know that there are good ways of using this model that will allow students to do more than they can currently do. It could be like you could imagine it as sort of like a research assistant for the student. It could, once the student figures out how to ask a question, maybe about one document, the student could train the model to then go ask that question for hundreds or thousands of documents and, organize an argument on a much bigger scale than they would otherwise have been able to do, for instance.
Ellie, what about you? Do you see, did you find as the semester went on, you had students and you were beginning to integrate GPT into your instruction, was it beneficial to students?
Yes. In fact, I think when I told students that they can use ChatGPT, they were kind of relieved, that I was okay with that.
Interesting.
But in general, I think tools like ChatGPT will force us as institution of higher education to rethink our pedagogy and basically how we evaluate our student. We need to find creative ways to incorporate these tools into our curriculum. We're training the future workforce who are going to probably be working with these tools on a daily basis. Therefore, the student needs to experiment with these tools and learn the strength and shortcomings of them, and basically to understand how they can complement AI tools with the skills that are, at least for the moment, specific to humans, such as critical thinking, problem solving, ethics, and collaboration.
That is such a good point, teaching them how to use these tools. And I think back, I mean, I went to college in the late 1990s. Wikipedia was brand new at that time and largely considered unreliable and forbidden for research. But there's a way to like learn how to use it. You know, if the sources of Wikipedia are well documented, you can maybe you don't trust the information that's on the page itself, but you can look to the primary sources as an example. We're going to talk more about this and the ways that AI may or may not disrupt our lives in higher education. When we return, we're talking with Ellie Buxton, who teaches computer science at the University of Illinois Springfield, and Ted Underwood, who is professor and associate dean for academic affairs in the School of Information Sciences at the U of I in Urbana. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. More to come on the 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about artificial intelligence and ChatGPT and their role in higher education. There's been some concern that students are using it to cheat, essentially, on assignments, having GPT do their writing work for them or their computer coding work for them. And yet there's also a push to find ways to integrate this technology, because the idea is it's going to become an essential tool for knowledge workers in the future. We're talking about this with Ellie Buxton, who's Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Illinois Springfield, and Ted Underwood, who is Associate Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor in the School of Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champain. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. Would you have liked to have had ChatGPT when you were in school? Are you optimistic or maybe nervous about the possibilities of AI in the future? 800-222-9455 to join us. 800-222-9455. So, Ellie, let's talk about some of that disruption that could be on the horizon. People have worried about changes and maybe making certain types of workers redundant. Higher education could be no exception. Do you think that professors should be worried about employment in the future as AI gets better and better?
I'm not too worried about that for professors or teachers, because teaching involves a lot of interaction with students that are don't think these AI systems are quite good at yet.
Yet, I guess. What about in computer coding? I have heard some speculation that that is one area that may be more ripe for disruption than others, because as these large language models get better and better at coding, maybe you won't need as many engineers. Is that do you see that, or do you think that's misguided or a misestimation of where things might be heading?
I think there is some truth to that, at least in my opinion. But these systems, they're still not quite good at creating a code that can solve more abstract problems. So we can't rely on the code that they produce. We can use it for generating what we call boilerplate code, which are code that are used with little variations in many different programs. The thing to note that systems like this, like ChatGPT, we have a version, similar version of that for coding for a while now. It's called GitHub Copilot, which basically assisted, and it was like auto-completion for coding. And so those systems cannot yet completely replace software developers, but they may reduce the number of software developers that are needed for the same level of productivity.
That's interesting. Go ahead. Sorry.
As far as the computer science education, I think the computer science education has to fundamentally change. And we need to focus more, maybe instead of teaching our students to write code, maybe we focus more in future to train our students to give for certain prompts to these AI systems to make them generate useful code, and then be able to read that code, interpret that code, and fix and debug the code. I think that's where we need to put more focus going forward, which requires basically more critical thinking and problem solving skills than doing like busy work.
Interesting. Ted, what about that again from the sort of information sciences, in more of a humanities context? What ways do you think that we should be integrating GPT and future iterations of this sort of programs into our curricula?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that they can do some of what teachers currently do, because actually the task of responding to a student essay in some ways is more routinized than the student's own work writing the essay. Every essay is different, but professors spend a lot of time saying, you need to make your thesis clearer, or there are two different versions of your thesis. And a model could probably do that. So I do think it's likely that AI will mean we need to have fewer people doing certain kinds of teaching work. But it will also mean we can raise our aim and teach students to do more. I think if we're honest, some classes have been asking students to sort of reinvent intellectual wheels, come up with a reading of the Iliad, but there are lots of readings of the Iliad. It's very likely that students are going to come up with something that's been said before. It's just that because we didn't know everything that was said before, there wasn't a good way of organizing it, that was okay in the past. In the future, we're really going to need to ask students to generate new knowledge. We're going to need to teach them how to come up with ideas that don't already exist. That will be better all around, I think.
That sounds like an interesting challenge because, I mean, that's asking a lot of students and faculty, right?
It is. Yeah. It's really, and it's something that, we haven't asked students to do in the past because it was too hard, really. But I suspect that with the assistance of tools like generative AI, students will be able to do more than they could 5 or 10 years ago. We could hand them, 1,000 short stories from the early 20th century and say, come up with something we don't yet know about the development of the detective story in the 20th century. And assisted by a tool that can read those detective stories and answer certain kinds of structured questions, point them in the right direction, they might be able to do that.
Interesting. Ted, a lot of the media coverage of AI and ChatGPT in the higher education context, it's focused on this potential cheating. What do you think of how the media has been covering AI in general so far?
It's not wrong to say that cheating is a bit of a challenge. There's higher education is almost sort of like going down. It feels like we're going down a waterfall or over some rapids, and our assignments haven't yet adapted yet. So journalists are right to point out that's a big challenge and that there's a lot of change going on. A few years ago, you would hear AI discussed as if it was this sort of scary robot, autonomous, it's going to replace you, does it have its own ideas, sort of. I feel like we've made some progress toward understanding that AI as it currently exists is not really it's not C-3PO, it's not walking around having its own ideas and desires. It's a model. It's a model of the world that you can use as a tool. And to the extent that we communicate that, we're doing better.
Interesting. I don't know. I'm still worried about the paperclip problem, but maybe that's a conversation for another show. Let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. We have Miriam calling in from Chicago on line 4. Miriam, thank you for calling.
You're most welcome.
So I understand you have a kid that went to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
I did. One of the things that was important was tutoring, and one of the hesitations with both of my children was the embarrassment factor of wanting to use a tutor. And you eliminate that if it's an AI tutor.
Oh, that's an interesting point. So remove some of the stigma, I guess, associated
exactly.
with,
and I
with
think,
yeah.
You know, and I think this actually probably should be used starting in middle school or whenever. I think we'll end up with a better educated society, and that's our goal.
Sure. All right. Thanks for sharing that, Miriam. I appreciate it. Ted, I guess that gets back at some of the things we were talking about earlier with the Saul Khan clip we listened to, this idea of AI tutors. Do you see a benefit there, I guess, with this stigma idea attached
sure.
to it?
Sure. I mean, it's just sort of the social friction in walking over to someone else and asking them a question. And you can't do that at, you know, 1 a.m. in the morning if, like some students, you happen to be writing your paper at 1 a.m. That does happen. but at 1 a.m. you can ask a model, what do you think of this idea? Help me brainstorm. That could be productive.
Yeah. Ellie, do you encounter that stigma with students needing extra help? Do you think AI has a role there?
Yes, I think it can certainly be helpful. And again, for us, you know, going back to coding, it can help students to get started, you know, because some students don't have any idea where to start. And so I think it's very helpful in that sense.
All right. So, Ted, were you going to say
well,
something?
Well, just, I mean, yeah. I certainly use it myself when I have questions. When I don't fully understand something, say I've read an article, I think I get the idea, but I'm not totally sure I understand how this concept would be used in practice. Follow-up questions are something the model is really good at. Now, I have to say, to do this best, I think we shouldn't imagine that the model contains within it all possible knowledge. That's probably not possible, and also just not really how this technology is best used. So you might want to give it the document you're asking a question about and say, you know, what does this writer mean by this concept? Am I interpreting it right? Not treating it as an oracle, but British programmer Simon Willison calls these models calculators for words. They don't contain all information, but they can help us reason about like a particular document if we hand it the document.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, we had an email come in from Jim who in Champaign who talked about it's been 50 years since he studied French, and he was a Peace Corps volunteer several decades ago and has been using Google Translate. So when he needs to write something in French, he starts in English, runs it through Google Translate, cross-checks the results with what he already knows. You know, there's some idioms that maybe don't translate properly, but for the most part, it's a pretty valuable tool in his perspective. Ellie, I wonder if, you know, we've been talking about GPT, but as, I mean, Translate, does what Google Translate works on, does that qualify as in the same ballpark as AI? And does that open up, you know, more cross-cultural collaborations, you know, as, you know, removing some of the language barriers that people might have?
Yes, the model that's underlying language translation is the same model that's underlying GPT models. It's basically a text-to-text model or a generative model that can generate a sequence, and it takes an input sequence, which is a language in French, for example, and then generate an output sequence, which is a language, which is text in English, translated text in English. I think, you know, I had personal experience with what this audience mentioned, that, you know, my husband, I'm from Iran, you know, when I traveled back to Iran, my husband had always had problem communicating with my mom. They always use sign language, but now they can use Google Translate because there's been this big leap of performance in the Google Translate. So I certainly agree to what the audience said. But one thing I want to point out is, and it's going back to what Ted also said, that we shouldn't trust 100% the output of these models. These generative models, they don't have any reference, physical reference of the symbols or words that they generate. So they generate these words, but they have absolutely no clue of what these words mean. So as a result, they might fabricate information that doesn't exist. So when you do a Google search, for example, you add that layer of human filtering on top of it. You go through the relevant documents, you check the sources, see which one is credible, which one is reliable. With these models, you cannot see the sources that they use. Therefore, you always should take the information that they produce with a grain of salt, knowing that they don't have an understanding of what they're saying.
Yeah, it's a simulacrum, if I'm saying that right, of human understanding, but it is just a facsimile of it. Let's see if we can get another call in. Bill is calling from Davenport, Iowa, in the Quad Cities on line 4. Bill, thank you for calling in.
Hi. I'm wondering if it would be technically feasible to require the people who make AI programs to put some kind of a digital watermark on the output of those programs so that a person could tell whether it was generated by an AI program or not.
Oh, interesting question, Bill. Thanks. Ellie, I'm going to pose that to you. I think GPT just outputs in plain text right now, right?
Right. But I have heard, that's a very good question. I actually have heard OpenAI is working on something like that. And it will be very useful for catching cheating. But there are other AI models that basically can say whether a text has been generated by AI or not. And I think OpenAI has put one system like that. But they're not perfect. You know, I have used some of these tools and I gave them the AI generated code and they weren't able to say whether they wrote it or not. So adding something like watermark, you know, would help. I also have heard that people will ask the AI itself, did you generate this text? And sometimes it's able to say, you know, yes or no. So
interesting. Oh, just about a minute left in our conversation. Ellie, what do you think about like an AI literacy course, right? Should this be a general education requirement for students in the future?
That's an excellent question. I would love to see a course like that being added to general education because the students in many different disciplines are going to use AI. So we're going to have to teach them how these systems work on a not very technical, but a higher level overview of how these systems work and what are their risks and how they can complement and collaborate with AI systems. I think that would be a great course to add for every major.
Ted, what do you think about that? And final thoughts. This will have to be our last comment in our conversation today.
Sure, yes, that could be a good idea. Although I would say there's existing courses in like the history of science and in machine learning that could also help students. If understanding the big picture is probably more important than really sort of narrowly targeted things to help with particular models.
Interesting. Yeah. And I guess the models will continue to evolve. We'll continue to follow it. Thank you so much to Ted Underwood from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Ellie Buxton from the University of Illinois Springfield. Appreciate you both making time to be with us today on the 21st show. Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking with the creator behind the rebooted Prairie Fire program, which documents the arts and culture of Illinois, downstate Illinois, and the broader Midwest. That's coming up after a short break here on the 21st show. We love hearing what you think about what we talked about on the program. If you don't want to call in real time, or maybe you're listening on our podcast, you can always let us know what you thought by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. Stay with us.